Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
President Obama says the U.S. will restart a diplomatic relationship with Cuba, but the deeper cultural and personal ties with the communist country may be harder to heal.
My mom and I both speak Spanish, but we were with a group of Americans, and I imagine some people didn't realize that we did speak Spanish, and one lady did tell her dog to bite my mother.
Also this week, could Florida become the first state to allow voting through the Internet? There are those who are urging caution.
We do believe there is a pretty clear history of problems and lack of security on this, and therefore we would approach this with a big yellow light.
We'll also get a preview of what might happen with Florida pension reform in 2015 and spend some time with a Florida teacher who's taken a whole year off to live as a homeless person. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The United States will resume diplomatic relations with Cuba, and reaction to that announcement has been mixed. The decision to normalize a relationship with the communist country could have a big impact on Florida for decades to come. We get more on that story from Lynn Hatter.
No one really knows how the newly revived relationship between Cuba and the United States will play out. But Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio says he thinks it will be a disaster.
In short, what these changes are going to do is they will tighten this regime's grip on power for decades to come.
Others, like FSU professor Alexander Avina, call the decision historic.
The symbolic nature of it is something that, as a historian who teaches the Cuban Revolution, is something that is really captivating me at this point.
Florida is deeply entwined with the Cuba issue. For one, a large number of South Florida is populated by Cuban Americans, many of whom, like Senator Rubio, have a deeply passionate and vested interest in the country. But according to studies done by Florida International University, opinions regarding the relationship between the communist country and the U.S. are changing. Many Cuban Americans, especially younger people, favor stronger ties with Cuba, and FSU's Avina says he sees that among the students he teaches.
You know, obviously they don't agree politically with the current Cuban government, but they want to be able to travel there. This has been long overdue, but it's been long overdue because of the foreign policy issues and then, you know, interconnected fashion, domestic political concerns with the political power that used to be wielded by the Cuban American population. That is also affected by demography, and that political influence has also started to lessen.
And it is the perception there in Cuba that it is the vocal minority of Cubans in America who have such influence over policy that is the reason for the justification for the embargo.
That's immigration lawyer Elizabeth Ritchie. Her family immigrated from Cuba a century ago, and she visited the country last year. Ritchie foresees the U.S. having to revamp its immigration policies toward Cuba, but she believes the revived diplomatic relationship could lead to more, especially when it comes to lifting an embargo which bans imports and exports to and from Cuba. That embargo has become a rallying symbol in the country, and Ritchie says she was welcomed on her visit, but the embargo was a sticking point.
Low birth rate, for example, came up over and over. The low birth rate in Cuba was attributed to the embargo. They have a similar birth rate to Japan and many developing countries, so it has nothing to do with the embargo. But the perception of the embargo is tremendous, and there are extremely deep and strong feelings about the embargo in Cuba and a lot of misconceptions about how it can be done away with.
If the U.S. does lift the embargo, and that's a big if given the Republican makeup of Congress, Florida could become an economic launchpad. The potential impact is outlined in a paper commissioned by the Florida Society of Association Executives, which envisioned this scenario 7 years ago. In that paper, the FSAE writes about a need for better infrastructure, IT, technology, and healthcare in Cuba, all areas that Florida businesses could serve. But the same document notes challenges and drawbacks and points out there are other countries and even other states in better position than Florida to start tapping into the Cuban market. Still, as immigration attorney Ritchie says, while some things will be easy, the hardest part will be cultural.
our tour guide, educated woman, a fidelista, someone who believes in Castro and his policies, and thought that we were the ones with the misconceptions.
Overcoming 50 years of history and animosity is not something that will happen overnight, but more of a goal to work toward. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Early voting, weekend voting, extended hours for voting. With so many conveniences, it seems few people would have any real excuse not to vote. But try doing it when you're thousands of miles from home and facing enemy fire. A bill filed by a Tampa lawmaker would make voting easier for military folks serving overseas. And Jim Ash reports it would make Florida the first state to have regular internet voting.
As a Marine corporal, 30-year-old Nathan French has served two tours in Iraq in 2004 and 2006. He was wounded twice fighting for his country. When it came to exercising his most fundamental civil right, voting, he had to struggle. Juggling absentee ballots was a big hassle when he spent most of his time on combat patrols or planning the next mission, and there was no telling if his votes would even reach his supervisor of elections on time.
You're outside the wire a lot, so you really don't have much time on the inside in order to sit back and fill out paperwork and do things of that nature. And what time you do have, you prefer to be on the phone or writing a letter to family.
Soldiers like French could vote with the touch of a button under an internet voting bill sponsored by Tampa Democratic Representative Janet Cruz. It would cut red tape by forcing state regulators to adopt online voting standards. Supporters say it's about time Florida's voting system joined the 21st century.
We are still approaching today absentee balloting for military voters using mostly the same methodology we've been using since the U.S. Civil War.
In a state famous for the presidential recount, and at a time when movie giant Sony is under a massive hack attack, internet voting is too far ahead of its time, says Florida League of Women Voters Deidre McNabb.
We do believe there is a pretty clear history of problems and lack of security on this, and therefore we would approach this with a big yellow light and caution.
Voting on computers, even when they're not connected to the Internet, has been fraught with problems in Florida. Malfunctions and disputed results ended in court battles. In 2006, when Congressman Vern Buchanan won by just 396 votes, his opponent went to court. The equipment manufacturer's refusal to hand over computer source codes raised questions about accurate recounts. In March 2012, faulty software in a local election in Palm Beach County attributed votes to the wrong election. A judge declared that the losers were actually the winners. That doesn't mean the state should stop trying to get it right, Lux says.
Nothing is ever 100% secure or can be. What we have to start thinking in terms of is, can we lower the risk to an acceptable level that the voters who need this type of service are willing to accept those risks?
Florida experimented with overseas internet votings six times with varied results. The plug was pulled on one pilot project after computer geeks working for the federal government were able to hack into the system. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Today, Governor Rick Scott declared an early victory in his job creation goal. Scott announced that Florida businesses have added nearly 716,000 private sector jobs since December of 2010, right before he began his first term in office. That number, he said, far surpassing his promise to create 700,000 jobs in 7 years. Just this past month, Scott said, Florida experienced the highest single month of private sector job growth, with over 38,000 jobs created. Florida's statewide unemployment rate in November was 5.8%. That was down 0.2 percentage points from October. Democrats were quick to counter Scott's statement, saying his original promise was to create 700,000 new jobs in addition to the state's normal job growth. That would require, they said, a total of 1.7 million jobs for the governor to reach his objective. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida Department of Health is holding another workshop for low THC marijuana at the end of the month, but some say the legislature should take the reins rather than let the issue go to voters in the next election.
I wouldn't worry about that. You know, to me, you just do the right thing. And don't worry about 16, it'll take care of itself.
Another year, another chance for the Florida legislature to reform pensions, although it now looks like state and local pension reform may be kept separate this go-around.
The public sector shouldn't necessarily act exactly like business, but we should always incorporate the best practices of business. And this is one of those where we have to catch up to what businesses have done.
And a Florida teacher who has gone homeless to raise awareness has advocates across the state talking about what they're calling housing first solutions. The Florida Department of Health has decided not to appeal a court ruling invalidating much of the agency's proposed rules for low THC marijuana. Nick Evans reports the rulemaking process gets a reset, but it doesn't necessarily mean a return to square one.
In the last legislative session, Florida lawmakers passed a bill allowing certain patients, mostly those suffering from severe epilepsy, to use marijuana products low in THC. THC is the chemical compound that makes users feel high, so the assumption is people are unlikely to abuse low THC products. But even so, getting that kind of legislation passed is a pretty big deal.
I mean, you were dealing with an extremely conservative Republican legislature in an election year. Who would have ever thought that it would have passed?
That's Ryan Wiggins, spokeswoman for Realm of Caring Florida. It's a nonprofit that advocates for low THC products, and its director, Holly Mosley, was instrumental in getting the legislation passed. But in the intervening months, the thorny process of implementing the law came to the fore. And the rules proposed by the Department of Health face significant criticism.
Like the lottery and the definition of applicant and the contiguous property versus, you know, only one location issue.
Independent inspection, the requirement for a licensing fee on top of an application.
That's Ron Watson and Louis Rotundo. Both are lobbyists who have been engaged with the rulemaking process from the start. And the problems they point out led to a successful court challenge. After its rules were thrown out, the Department of Health refused to discuss whether it planned to appeal, instead issuing a one-sentence statement saying it would consider all options in getting low THC marijuana to patients as expeditiously as possible. Then on Monday, December 15th, the deadline for filing an appeal, the department announced it would not, and it announced another public workshop for developing rules. Watson says he's frustrated with the department's timing.
Frankly, I'm not surprised they chose not to appeal. I'm a little disappointed that they took the entire 30 days to make that decision. In all fairness, I know that with the election and, you know, possible turnover of agency heads and things like that, maybe that's, you know, what they needed all the time for.
And Rotundo agrees.
Now, as to their timing, I'm very disappointed that another 4 weeks has gone by.
And on top of all this is the announcement the following day of a leadership change in the office charged with writing the rules. But here's the thing. All of them, Wiggins, Watson, and Rotundo, are complimentary of outgoing director Linda McMullen, and they're optimistic for the future for various reasons. Wiggins says the Mosley family is relying on faith.
The one thing that Peyton and Holly have always held to is that this is a God thing. And so when you leave it up to God, there's not a whole lot of fear you can have there. And
Watson points out the department has a solid foundation, even if it needs to make some changes.
But I guess what I would assume, and that's all it is an assumption, is that part of the rules coming back that weren't specifically challenged that a lot of us had thought were pretty good would probably remain in place.
And they all point out the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Here's Rotundo.
A lot of legislators, regardless of their personal beliefs, saw 58% of the people of Florida vote for something and heard from their cousin, their aunt, their brother-in-law, their best friend that there are a number of illnesses which may benefit from this drug.
Incoming Senate President Andy Gardner says he's heard some lawmakers are interested in revisiting the issue, but he dismisses suggestions the legislature should take up broader legalization in the wake of Amendment 2's near passage last month. Some have argued this could short-circuit a potential ballot initiative in the next election.
I think there'll be some that will say, well, we got to do X, Y, or Z because try to avoid a constitutional amendment in 2016. I would caution everybody that I wouldn't worry about that. You know, to me, you just do the right thing. And don't worry about 16. It'll take care of itself.
When the workshop convenes in Orlando later this month, it's not clear if the department will bring draft rules based on its earlier efforts or if it will return to a blank slate. Whatever the case, for patients eager to begin treatment, it appears they'll remain in limbo for the foreseeable future. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
An application by Daytona International Speedway for $90 million in state sales tax dollars to aid ongoing renovations at the racetrack is now being reviewed for its economic viability. Paperwork for the Speedway reached the point where it was deemed complete this week. That, according to an email from State Department of Economic Opportunity spokeswoman Jessica Sims. Meanwhile, a proposal from South Florida Stadium LLC filing for the Miami Dolphins home, which is Sun Life Stadium, was the first of four stadium funding applicants to reach the review stage last Friday. Under a new funding process crafted by state lawmakers earlier this year, applications were due November 1st, but the review process doesn't begin until the paperwork's considered complete. The Department of Economic Opportunities Division of Strategic Business Development continues to work with Jacksonville and Orlando, meanwhile, to obtain information needed to complete their applications. The four venues are in a competition for this year's pot of $7 million in state sales tax dollars for stadium projects. Pension reform is expected to be back before Florida lawmakers during the 2015 session. Could this be the year such reform actually takes place? What about overhauling the Florida retirement system, which so many analysts insist is sound and doesn't need reforming? Sasha Cordner reports on what stakeholders are hoping for in the new year.
Rob Weissert is the chief research officer for Florida Tax Watch, a government watchdog group which recently released its annual cost savings report. One area Weissert says state government could save some money is by overhauling the Florida retirement system. The report's recommendation is similar to the 2014 proposal that failed, steering newly hired employees into a 401k-style pension plan, thus phasing out the more popular option, the traditional pension plan. While proponents to the overhaul say it will help avoid billions of dollars in future liabilities, opponents say the legislature shouldn't be tinkering with the FRS system that's widely seen as financially sound. Still, Weissert says the state should be matching its retirement plans to look like the private sector.
Clearly, the legislature has looked at this over a few years. There's a number of issues that need to be considered, but the two major issues here from the Government Efficiency Task Force standpoint are the financial stability that this will ensure. With more than a $20 billion unfunded liability, even with fantastic asset management at the state level, this is a system that simply needs to be looked at again, and modernizing the system to match what the taxpayers who fund the system have available to them.
The controversial 2014 state pension reform effort also included a widely supported bipartisan local pension reform measure. It was intended to help troubled pension programs mainly affecting police and firefighters. Many of those pensions are underfunded. The two pension efforts were tied together in the House in an effort to get state pension reform passed, but both efforts ended up dying in the last days of session. So far, the local pension bill has been filed again, and Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says he and Margate Democrat Jeremy Ring share one hope for 2015.
The FRS issue and the local pension issue, I think it's very important that those two issues are separate.
And for now, House Speaker Steve Crisafulli confirms the two issues are separate.
They can definitely move separately. I mean, they have been tied together in the past, but as far as the conversations that are being had right now, they are separate.
That's good news to Florida League of Cities Legislative Director Scott Dudley. After years of grappling with this issue, he says he's hopeful local pension reform will get passed during the 2015 session, whether it's in another bill or a standalone measure.
We'll take it in whatever form it comes, as long as it can get done. But the idea that he's willing to separate them shows that he's committed to getting either or both done, and we appreciate that, so that we can make the systems more sustainable, the pension systems more sustainable into the future so we can follow up with the promises that we've made to the police and firefighters.
And as for state pension reform, House Speaker Chris Cifulli says the House is not ruling out bringing back that issue next year.
If there's not an appetite for it in the Senate, then it potentially won't happen. But certainly in the House, we have members that are talking about it.
Senate President Andy Gardner recently told reporters he sees the two pension efforts as separate. He also pointed to how the local pension reform effort has unanimous support in the Senate, but the votes for overhauling the Florida Retirement System, or FRS, are pretty divided, with some Republicans siding with Democrats against that effort.
You know, the votes haven't changed in the Senate. And we have to be mindful of that, you know. And I did see where the speaker commented that they were going to be separated in the House and not put together. So it may give you the opportunity to do the local fix, and then you just kind of wait and see what happens on the overall FRS reform.
And how does Matt Puckett feel about Gardner's remarks? He's the executive director of the Florida Police Benevolent Association, who's been very involved with the local pension reform bill in years past.
Very encouraged. You know, we worked very hard over the last few years to try to get a product that everybody could agree was a good compromise, and we feel like we're there with the legislation that was produced last year. So it's very encouraging that the Senate president recognizes that and is supporting it moving forward.
Puckett says he likes the idea of a standalone local pension reform bill, but he adds for the issues to be tied together, the two pension efforts would both have to be something that the police union could support. Of course, he says if it were to look anything like last year's state pension reform effort,
we'd really prefer in that scenario to have the two run separately.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Weighing allegations of bias, a Florida appeals court today rejected an attempt to block a circuit judge from presiding over cases involving the Orlando Police Department. Prosecutors had sought to disqualify Orange County Circuit Judge Timothy Shea from Orlando police cases because of critical comments he made back in August and September about officers not showing up for depositions. During a September 30th pretrial conference, for instance, a defense attorney requested a continuance in a case because an Orlando police officer didn't appear for the deposition, and Judge Shea singled out the department and then ordered every attorney in the room to initiate contempt proceedings against any OPD officers who fail to appear for depositions. A three-judge panel of the appeals court concluded the allegations did not justify disqualifying Shea in every case involving the Orlando police. You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, this is the time of year when more people than usual consider the plight of those described as less fortunate, thus all the toy and food drives that accompany the holidays. But after the holidays and the outpouring of kindness that accompanies them are over, the less fortunate are still around. Now a Central Florida middle school teacher has the year off to explore Florida not as a tourist, but as a homeless person. Regan McCarthy reports Tom Rebman is spending his nights sleeping on the ground or in shelters while surviving off of whatever donations he can get. He wants to teach Floridians about the more than 40,000 of their neighbors who no longer have a neighborhood to call their own.
Tom Rebman is wearing an acid-wash denim jacket, a black beanie, and torn jeans. It's cold here in North Florida, and a pair of long johns peek through the tear near his knee. His face is weathered, covered in a few days' worth of salt and pepper stubble, but the lines on his face frame clear blue eyes full of passion.
Let me just say this. I don't even like to say homeless people. It's people who are homeless, because they're not homeless first. They're people first.
That's the center of Redman's campaign. He's a teacher, but he says now, instead of teaching middle school kids to read, he teaches Floridians that the homeless guy they pass every day is a person, who Rebman says can only be helped by being treated like a person.
You know, when they know somebody wants to help them, they'll achieve. They have somebody that cares about them. That's what they're missing. Because you know what I needed more than a hug or a blanket? Or excuse me, a blanket or a... I needed a hug. I need somebody that made me feel human.
Redman says the best way to start is with no rules attached housing. And director of Florida's Office on Homelessness, Eric Braun, agrees when it comes to the state's chronically homeless, the so-called housing first model is the best choice.
Get them into a home, a fixed and stable residence where they can be at home, they can feel like they have a place to call their own, where they can cook their meals, where they can sleep in safety. This is a baseline need. It's the baseline need for me. At the end of my day, I get to go home. Nobody has 10 rules for me to be in my home.
Braun defines chronically homeless as a person who suffers from a mental or physical disability or substance abuse, who sleeps outside or in public spaces, and who's been living on the street for more than a year. Braun and Redman met during Redman's stop in Tallahassee, where he lived as a homeless person, and the two generally agree on the best practices for addressing homelessness. Although Braun points out that the chronically homeless, which Redman is highlighting, make up just 20% of the state's homeless population.
The largest percentage of homeless are going to be those who are in different areas of homelessness. But like, if we're going to target family homelessness, that's going to be a much bigger issue, because there's all sorts of issues related to their homelessness in terms of transportation, housing, employment. Those are all poverty issues. Those are all economic factors.
And in fact, Redman says that less visible form of homelessness is what drove him to start his project. Redman works at a school where 97% of the students receive free or reduced lunches, meaning most of the school's students live at or below the poverty line.
How am I going to get these kids to read over the summer? They're not going to read a book or assignment if I send it home. I mean, these kids don't have windows in their trailers. They don't even know if mom and dad's going to be home tonight. They're going to worry about a book? No.
It's hard to get an accurate count of who is homeless in Florida. A 2014 report from Florida's Council on Homelessness counts more than 40,000 people living on the streets, but that's based on a single count done at a specific time that not every county completed. Public schools list more than 70,000 students who were homeless at some point during 2013 based on a broader definition of homelessness that includes sleeping in shelters, cars, or with friends or family. And Redman says that's what's important to remember. People who are homeless are children, families, veterans, and hard workers who lost a job and are struggling to make ends meet. He hopes through raising awareness and compassion, he can help. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Nick Evans. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.